if you want to do that, then you can speak and you can sit here. And I'm very grateful.
Yep, there is.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, and welcome to everybody for finding their way. Those of you who don't work in the library get a full tour of the library to find this corner of it, following all those arrows. Thank you for having us here today. The reason today's presentation has come about is that a couple of weeks ago, the Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council heard a presentation from a group of experts in the field of epidemics. And I, as one of the members of that council, but others as well, found the report particularly useful. And of course, we know it's extremely topical. So I suggested to the group and to Penny Sackett, our chief scientist, that maybe it would be appropriate to provide this information more widely within the Parliament, because it was so useful and there has been so much interest in the first outbreak of a global pandemic for nearly 40 years, and it really puts things in context. I'm conscious that the extraordinarily good work that many of our scientists and innovators do day in and day out is not always seen by the general public or indeed researchers and other interested participants in public life. And whilst we value having that advice coming to us as government and cabinet ministers, I think it's really valuable, and I very much appreciate Penny and the library agreeing to facilitate this as an opportunity for us to pass on some of that good work and expertise, and of course to have some of the, not just national leaders, but world leaders here to present this information and answer your questions is really great. So thank you very much, Penny, for making that happen. Thank you for the library for all of the logistics in making it happen. And thank you, of course, to Anne and Stephen, who you will hear from throughout the course of this session. Can I also acknowledge that Professor Jim Bishop is here, the Chief Medical Officer, obviously a man with a lot on his hands at the moment, but it's been really valuable for the government to have such high quality medical advice, of course drawn upon then all of the expert groups that provide him with information. And I understand that Jim will endeavour to be around for a little while in case there are questions that people might also want to ask to him. I have to apologise in advance that I will be sneaking out at about 1 o'clock. It's a question time day and there are always far too many things for us to try to do. So apologies if I am leaving in the middle of one of the presentations. Just briefly, I guess I wanted to set a little bit of context, because what I think is interesting about the presentation that you're about to see is it shows you the current debate about the swine flu pandemic is actually in a context of dealing with influenza over many decades, and the sorts of things that have been learnt about the spread of different types of disease, and obviously the work and information that many scientists and researchers have done over time have put us in a good position, to put the world in a good position to be able to respond to new and changing threats. I believe, and I do admit to being biased, but I think that as a country we can be proud of the response that we've had to date to the swine flu pandemic. I think the response at our borders bought us a bit of time to understand the virus better and prepare our response, but we are moving into a difficult phase. Obviously we've seen the first two deaths, probably from other underlying conditions, but nevertheless of patients with swine flu, and we're certainly moving into a heavier flu season, and we'll no doubt be confronted with difficult circumstances in the coming weeks and months. I do want to thank the health authorities, all of the state and territory governments, of course the medical and nursing workforce, who have worked really well on this coordinated response. I might leave the rest of the details to our presenters, who of course are talking more generally to you about influenza than about swine flu. It might be useful to remind people, because I think there is an unusual mix of people who are here to hear this presentation, that we have now moved, of course, to a protect phase in Australia. We do base our response on assumptions that have now been publicly released, which is an attack rate of about 20%. In other words, that one in five Australians could be infected. Of course, that's the assumption if there was no medical intervention or public health intervention. And of course, our efforts are being moved towards making sure that those public health interventions will make a difference. Our aim is to reduce the impact and identify and treat early those who are likely to be most vulnerable to the disease. I was going to talk to you a little bit about appropriate use of antivirals and all those sorts of things. I might leave that to people later if questions want to be asked, but obviously there are some clear guidelines. I think it is obviously difficult for people to understand when they should be provided with antivirals and when they shouldn't. That's why we urge people not to worry if they're having mild symptoms, but to make sure that they do get advice and medical advice, particularly if they are in some of the vulnerable categories. And all of our ability to be able to target these messages really in one way or another comes down to the work of scientists and researchers and the great work that has been done here and overseas. But I wanted to say, in introducing Penny to come up and introduce our speakers, that we are very lucky to have a country that not only has a very good health system, but is full of wonderful researchers. And I think that this is an important opportunity to be able to thank them for the work that they do and show off a bit of their skills. And the best person, of course, to do that is our chief scientist, Professor Penny Sackett, who is going to introduce our presenters today. So welcome, Penny.
Thank you, the Honourable Minister Watson, senators, members, and parliamentary staff. I'm going to try to keep my time very brief indeed because I want to leave most of it for the presenters, the expert presenters, and indeed any questions that you might have as well. We'll see if we have the technology here. You're going to help me with this, aren't you?
Indeed.
Thank you. I probably should admit to being a Mac user most of my life. Most of my recent life. As chief scientist, I am actually the executive officer of the Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council. That meets twice a year with the full ministerial complement, the Prime Minister present and ministers present. I'm going to very briefly talk to you about what we're doing in PIMSEC to set the scene for how expert working reports like this one come forward. Of course, what we want to do in the council is increase awareness of the importance of science to Australian society and also help the government prepare for the future using evidence and foresight. And this foresight function is particularly important as released in the Government Innovation Agenda paper. And I quote from that PIMSEC will look over the horizon and provide the strategic foresight needed to support long-term whole-of-government policy development. So what we are increasingly about is questions that affect all of government, cross-portfolio, that we take the long-term view, and I think you'll understand why that's important when you listen to the presentations, and that, of course, we think strategically, identifying those issues which are most important to Australia. And in doing so, we ask questions like this. What might the future look like for Australia on 5, 10, 20, perhaps even 50-year timescales? How can we prepare better for possible transformational changes in Australia and how her citizens can react to change? What are the gaps in our knowledge? What do we need to know now that we do not currently know to prepare for those possible transformational futures? And of course, in particular, how can science and innovation, which are already integral parts of society, contribute to being prepared? And so the foresight process begins with understanding the present, with cataloging what could possibly take place in the near-term future, and then imagining possible futures in the distance, and asking which ones of those are transformational, and also asking where those gaps in our knowledge are. Those are the gaps that we want to be filled. We've identified our work in four key areas. Climate change, energy, water, and the environment is one. Knowledge generation, skills, and perception in a global world is a second. Science as an engine for innovation in commerce, industry, and the arts, a third cross-portfolio area of work, and national health, well-being, and security, the long view. So within those clusters, we are beginning to look out over the horizon and ask where transformational change may take place for Australia, And the work of the expert working groups, like the one that you'll hear from just now, is to fill those gaps where possible, and where not possible because it's too complex at the moment, at least to scope the size of the gap in our knowledge and ask how we can best go forward to prepare for those possible futures. So the work from those clusters goes to the PIMSEC Standing Committee, which is all of the PIMSEC members minus the ministerial complement. They present first ideas to the full PIMSEC. We had a first example of that on 5 June, which provides feedback to the Standing Committee. And then working together with the Office of the Chief Scientist and Expert Working Groups, we arrive at detailed reports that can be presented back to PIMSEC. And that is what happened on 5 June with an Expert Working Group report on epidemics in a changing world. So what you will hear next is then the scientific summary of that report, and we hope to give you enough time that you can ask questions of the experts who really know the scientific detail behind the changes that we might see in Australia due to epidemics and the scientific basis of our understanding going backward in time. So without further ado, and I'll ask for some help in changing the presentation, I'll ask the first of our two speakers, Professor Ann Kelso. Now, Minister Roxon mentioned that these people are not only experts in Australia, but indeed key experts when you look at the global context. And certainly for Anne, who is director of a World Health Organization collaborating center for reference and research on influenza, you can be assured that we have one of the world's experts working here in Australia, one who was not only preparing this report during the important last weeks and months, but actually also contributing expertise to help the world respond to the current H1N1 virus. So I invite Anne. Thank you very much.
The Honourable Minister Roxon, Senators, Members and Parliamentary Staff. It's a privilege to be given this opportunity to talk with you today, and I thank Professor Sackett for that introduction. This year we've witnessed the worst Australian outbreak of dengue in 50 years and the beginning of the first influenza pandemic in 40 years. These events remind us that despite the extraordinary advances of the 20th century, we're still vulnerable to infectious disease, medically, socially, and economically, and particularly to the major catastrophic eruptions of disease that occur several times a century. Humans and animals have always coexisted with infectious disease agents, and many of them are familiar enemies to us. But new ones continue to emerge and the old ones continue to evolve. We can predict that catastrophic epidemics will occur, but as with our recent experience of the swine flu epidemic, we can't predict when or where these events will happen. We must expect to be surprised. It's one of the great triumphs of human endeavour that the WHO, with a massive vaccination program, completely eliminated one of the scourges of infectious diseases of the past centuries. So far, it's the only infectious disease that it's been possible to eliminate, and it won't be possible to eliminate many others, but we must therefore focus on minimising their impact. In doing so, we're challenged by change, new and evolving infectious disease agents, and a world which, thanks to our activities, is changing more rapidly than ever before. These are the issues that the expert working group, which the membership is shown here, addressed in the report. I'm going to use three contemporary examples of infectious agents to illustrate the impact of our changing world on epidemic threats in Australia. They're influenza, dengue, and blue tongue virus. So the first is influenza. In humans, pigs and horses, influenza is a virus, is caused by a virus that infects the nose, throat and lungs, and it's spread by droplets that we produce through coughing and sneezing. It's a highly contagious disease, as we've seen recently. It's not new. Humans have lived with influenza for centuries and probably for millennia. And we've been making effective vaccines in Australia since the 1940s. But there are two problems with the influenza virus. And the first is that human influenza viruses in particular are continually changing. The second is that influenza viruses can cross to humans and other animals from their natural reservoir, which is water birds. The influenza virus changes in two different ways. First, as shown in the top of this slide, it mutates. Spot changes in the genetic code progressively change the virus, allowing development of new variants that can resist antiviral drugs or the antibodies that our immune systems make in response to infection with the flu virus or to vaccination. The second way the virus changes is shown in the second lower part of the slide, and that's called reassortment. And this is because the genetic material of the influenza virus is in 8 separate pieces, as shown with the stripes there. So when two different flu viruses infect an animal at the same time, there's the possibility that these viruses can mix in one cell and create a new combination of those 8 pieces of genetic code. Occasionally, a new combination is more effective than the earlier version. Pigs are a particularly important so-called mixing vessel for the creation of new influenza viruses because they're easily infected by flu viruses from humans, animals, and birds. Now, influenza viruses are circulating in humans somewhere in the world all the time, causing epidemics that we see every winter in temperate climates, and that's what's shown here for Australia, with a very clear spike of flu cases each winter. We see less predictable waves in the tropics and the subtropics, but nevertheless epidemics do occur in those parts of the world, as shown here for Hong Kong. But you can see that they're much less predictable and there can be one or two a year in Hong Kong. Seasonal patterns of flu infection depend on a number of factors. They're complex, but they include humidity, temperature, human behaviour, and other factors that aren't very well understood yet. And altogether, these result in the seasonal spikes that we see. We can be certain that climate change will alter the location, timing, and magnitude of influenza epidemics, but we can't predict in exactly which way this will happen. These seasonal influenza viruses are changing all the time by mutation, so our immunity is progressively less effective. This is why we update our flu vaccines almost every year, so that the vaccine contains the latest strains of the virus that are circulating in the world at that time. Mutation has also allowed some influenza viruses to become resistant to antiviral drugs, such as Tamiflu. But from time to time, an influenza virus undergoes such a major change that we have no immunity to it at all. And such viruses spread very rapidly around the world, causing a pandemic. Sometimes these viruses also cause very severe disease. The 1918 influenza pandemic, the worst of them all, was caused by unusual mutations in a bird virus. Equine influenza, although it was much less severe than the 1918 virus, is also caused by a mutated bird virus. On the other hand, the 1957 and the 1968 pandemics were caused by the second process of reassortment of a human influenza virus with a bird flu virus. The new human H1N1 influenza virus that's spreading in Australia at the moment was created by reassortment of two different swine influenza viruses. One of the partners in that event had also itself been created by a series of reassortment events that happened at least 10 years ago. So this new virus has caught us by surprise. First, because it hadn't been circulating in pigs, and second, because it emerged in North America, not in Asia, which is where we've been particularly looking for new flu viruses. We still don't know where or when this virus was first formed from the partners shown there, and we also can't predict how it's now going to evolve. Equine influenza presents a different type of threat from the swine flu virus. In August 2007, the H3N8 equine influenza virus was carried from an imported thoroughbred out of the Eastern Creek quarantine station in Sydney into the domestic horse population via a series of equestrian events that are shown there at Narrabri, Maitland and Centennial Park. Although this virus can be found in most countries of the world, we didn't have it in Australia up till that point, and our horses in the domestic population had no immunity to it. So the spread of the virus was explosive, and in a way very like what we're currently seeing now with swine flu in kids in Australia. Between August and December 2007, approximately 80,000 horses were infected in almost 11,000 premises over an area of 283,000 square kilometres. More than 300,000 doses of vaccine were used. Race meetings were stopped in New South Wales and Queensland for 3 months. And the outbreak cost more than $350 million to the government for eradication and industry assistance. And the total industry costs have been estimated at about $1 billion. Now, this infection actually doesn't kill many horses, but it affects performance in racing and in equestrian events, and it affects our horse exports. Australia paid a very high price to regain its disease-free status. The 1918 influenza pandemic in humans was exceptionally severe. At least 40 million people died, compared with about a quarter to a half a million people who die each year from seasonal influenza around the world. And whereas seasonal influenza mainly affects the very young and the very old, the 1918 virus mainly killed young adults between the ages of about 20 and 40. In some isolated populations, as shown here for a village in Alaska, only the children survived. These populations hadn't been exposed to flu viruses before, and there was little immunity. The virus was spread by people in 1918 and 1919, on foot, in vehicles, on ships. Islands that imposed strict maritime quarantine, like American Samoa in the Pacific, were spared. Others that didn't, like New Zealand, suffered very heavy tolls. And in fact, Western Samoa, as opposed to American Samoa, lost 20% of its entire population to pandemic influenza. In Australia, through maritime quarantine, we delayed the entry of the 1918 virus for quite some months and missed the most virulent wave that was seen in the Northern Hemisphere. Despite that, more than 12,000 Australians died. So what's different today, and how will our risk from such a pandemic change in the future? Well, the first change is human mobility. Over a single day, there's massive traffic between the major centres of the world, and we, all of us probably in this room, participate in that global air traffic. Viruses that took weeks and months to spread around the world in the first half of the 20th century now only take hours and days. Today, we can use quarantine to keep out animal infections, like equine influenza, but for humans, border controls and quarantine can only buy us some time. Another very important way and change in recent times is the way that we live. Most of us live in cities. We mix with large numbers of people every day on public transport, in supermarkets, in our businesses, at the football and the cricket. We travel widely across town and across the country for work and for leisure. Our children, who are the super spreaders of respiratory viruses, are gathered in childcare centres and schools. We take holidays in cruise ships. Our elderly and infirm live in institutions. Another change is community health. Many of us are experiencing better health than our parents and grandparents, but many others suffer chronic diseases or take immunosuppressive drugs that increase susceptibility to infectious disease. The average age of our population is increasing. These factors, increasing mobility and mixing, changes in community health and demography, will persist and perhaps even increase for the foreseeable future. These factors have all played a role in the spread of the new H1N1 virus from the US and Mexico, along flight paths, in cities and between children, to 99 countries in 8 weeks. The way humans manage domestic animals is also changing dramatically. The H5N1 bird flu virus has spread across Asia, into Europe and Africa, mainly through the poultry trade. The density of domestic ducks and chickens in parts of Asia has increased enormously over 10 years. Poultry and pigs still live together in backyards in many countries, increasing the chance of cross-species mixing of influenza viruses. Poultry are sold in live bird markets, where large numbers of birds are brought from outlying areas and mixed together. Infected birds and poultry products are transported illegally across borders, and farmers can't afford to cull their sick poultry, and governments can't afford to compensate them for that loss of primary income, and in fact for many people their primary protein source. The most seriously affected countries don't have the resources to change these practices. So this virus is now very widespread in underdeveloped countries and can't be eliminated. We can't hope now to eliminate the H5N1 bird flu virus. Humans can be infected when they have close contact with H5N1 infected poultry, and of those who fall ill, about 60% die. At the moment, those viruses don't spread easily between humans. So one of the biggest risks we face from influenza in the coming years is that this virus, the avian flu virus, which causes extremely severe disease in humans, will mutate or mix with a human seasonal virus, or perhaps with the new swine lineage virus, to create a new virus with the worst properties of both, the ability to spread easily between humans and to cause severe disease. This situation has arisen from a collision between traditional farming practices with no biosecurity and our globalised modern world. We therefore depend on other positive changes of recent times. We know much more about these viruses than we did before. We've got better methods to detect them, to analyse them, and to use them for vaccine production and antiviral development. The quality, range, and availability of vaccines for many diseases have increased enormously in recent decades. Over the last 5 years, concerns about the H5N1 bird flu virus have driven government spending, especially in the US, and this in turn has driven fantastic innovation and increased capacity in the influenza vaccine industry. Our own vaccine company, CSL Limited, contributes to this global capacity. We also have antiviral drugs for influenza that didn't exist until the late 1990s, Tamiflu and the Australian invention Relenza. We learned last year, in fact, that Tamiflu-resistant viruses can not only emerge, but they can also spread around the world without Tamiflu use. So we rely now on continuing innovation to ensure that new drugs are developed. The WHO's 60-year-old Global Influenza Surveillance Network, of which our centre is a part, continues to strengthen, and it's a model for global cooperation in monitoring and responding to infectious disease. Global networks like the WHO's are supported by faster, more extensive international communication systems. And awareness of the pandemic threat in Australia and elsewhere has stimulated improvements in disease surveillance, that's certainly true in Australia, and preparations for integrated national and state-based emergency response. All of these improvements are bearing on our ability to respond to the new influenza pandemic today. I want now to spend a few minutes talking about two other viruses that illustrate quite different challenges now and in the future. And the first is the dengue viruses. These viruses cause dengue fever, which is a severe flu-like illness, and sometimes the more extreme dengue hemorrhagic fever, which is especially dangerous in children. About 2/5 of the world's population, which is 2.5 billion people, are now at risk of dengue. WHO estimates that there may be as many as 50 million infections per year, with about 500,000 cases of dengue hemorrhagic fever, of whom about 2.5% die even with treatment. The death rate's much higher in the absence of treatment. But there are no specific drugs for the prevention or treatment of dengue, and no vaccine is yet available. Dengue viruses are transmitted by mosquitoes, and two species in particular, Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. Now, these mosquitoes breed in still water in containers, such as water storage jars and discarded tyres. In fact, international trade in tyres has helped dengue mosquito vectors spread into new locations around the globe, at the same time as the rapid rise in urban populations is bringing more people into contact with those mosquito vectors. The chief ways to control the dengue viruses is to prevent mosquito bites and particularly to prevent breeding of the mosquito vector, for example, by eliminating open water stores. But that's easier said than done in many communities. Dengue fever is mainly a virus of the tropics and subtropics, and it's sensitive, therefore, to the impact of climate change. This slide shows in yellow the areas of the world currently at risk of dengue transmission. But WHO reports that climate change is expected to increase the proportion of the world's population exposed to dengue virus from about 35 to 40% now to about 60% by later in this century. With climate change, we can expect that in general the geographic range of mosquito vectors will expand. For dengue, the primary vector, Aedes aegypti, is already here in Australia. Now the secondary vector, Aedes albopictus, is on our doorstep in the Torres Strait, and it's expected to begin spreading south through eastern Australia within 5 years. And climate models suggest that it could reach as far south as Melbourne. This would be expected to affect the transmission of dengue virus here and other viruses such as chikungunya. Paradoxically, the recent drought has increased the risk of dengue virus infection in southeast Queensland. This is because climate change, along with increasing population density and changes in household behaviour, affects water storages. Water tanks were banned for many years in Brisbane, but were then reintroduced a few years ago in response to low rainfall and water restrictions. They now provide a potential breeding ground for Aedes aegypti in Brisbane and elsewhere in Australia. There have been several dengue outbreaks in Queensland this year, including a record epidemic in Cairns, with more than 900 people infected, and the seeding of epidemics in other towns. Dengue has the potential to become a much larger problem in Australia in the future. Blue tongue viruses are another remarkable example of the effect of climate change. This is emerging now in many parts of the world. This family of viruses mainly affects sheep, also goats and deer, and until recently only rarely cattle. Not all animals develop symptoms, but all those that do lose condition rapidly, and the sickest die within a week. For affected animals which do not die, recovery takes several months. Blue tongue viruses are transmitted by a certain species of biting midge, shown there. The incidence and geographical distribution of the virus depends on the presence of the vector, the availability of susceptible animals, and the weather. The insect prefers warm, humid conditions, and so it's in its greatest numbers and most active after rains. Blue tongue viruses have been seen in many countries of the world, including Australia. Outbreaks of blue tongue in Europe used to be rare and short-lived, but since 1998, the virus has spread northward from the Mediterranean, carried by midge species that are widespread in Europe, and helped by milder winters that have allowed both the virus and the vector to survive longer through each year. In 2006, cases were found in the Netherlands for the first time, and from there, the disease has spread to many countries, reaching north to Denmark and Sweden in 2008, as shown in colour there, and now in 2009, as far north as Norway. One of the virus types has become more virulent for cattle, and as a result, in Europe now, more than 2 million sheep and cattle have died from this disease. This loss of stock and costs of control have been devastating for industry. The disease hasn't yet occurred in Australia. However, midges carrying the virus enter northern Australia every summer. Two new viruses have been detected in Australia just in the last 12 months, and a new vector has just been detected here. There's concern that changing climate will alter the distribution of the insect vectors, bringing the virus and susceptible animal flocks into contact. This is a significant imminent threat. Each disease has its own story, but these three viruses, influenza, dengue, and blue tongue, illustrate some of the ways in which our changing world is affecting epidemic threats to Australia. I'll now ask Professor Prowse to, Professor Sackett wishes to introduce Professor Prowse.
Thank you very much. We do have a second part to this presentation. I'm sure you want to thank Anne now, as well as reserve some questions for her later. So please, let's. And I'd, Now my pleasure. I just wanted to make sure that I properly introduce to you Professor Stephen Krause, who will give the second piece of this presentation, and particularly to let you know that he speaks also from very strong credentials as the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Biosecurity CRC, that's Cooperative Research Centre, for Emerging Infectious Disease. So please, Professor Krause.
Professor Kelso has given you examples of three different diseases, as she said, each with their own unique characteristics that highlights the factors involved in disease emergence. And what I want to do now is discuss those factors a little further. We are now in a period where we are seeing more infectious disease epidemics, many of them completely unexpected. SARS is an example of an epidemic of a completely new disease that took everyone by surprise. It emerged from humans and was subsequently discovered to have moved from fruit bats to animals in markets and then to humans. Epidemics can also be caused by known diseases that have re-emerged, for example, as we are currently seeing with the H1N1 swine flu. These are diseases that have changed in some particular way, in that they cause more serious disease, for example, as we heard about blue tongue in Northern Europe, or diseases that have moved into a new geographic location, such as the recent spread of rabies into Bali, or where they've moved into a completely new host, for example, the outbreak of Ebola Reston in the Philippines recently. What is clear is that we'll be surprised by outbreaks of these new diseases and by diseases that have re-emerged, and so we need to be expecting the unexpected. These diseases are important because they cause significant loss of life and serious illness. Epidemics of influenza have caused a huge loss of life in the past. The losses associated with Spanish flu have already been mentioned. And as we know, 40 million people died, compared with 8 million in World War I. It should also be noted that 3 million people died in two influenza epidemics in 1957-58 and 68-69. In Australia, between 1,000 and 3,000 people die every year from seasonal influenza. In addition to this, epidemics place enormous strains on healthcare systems. Disease epidemics also have large economic impacts through direct loss of production in the livestock sector, the cost of interventions, and the loss of access to markets. Avian influenza is estimated to have cost US $20 billion globally. The recent Australian outbreak of equine influenza cost approximately $1 billion. The 2001 outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the United Kingdom cost £3.1 billion, and it's been estimated that a 12-month outbreak of foot and mouth disease of similar magnitude to this outbreak in Australia would cost between $8 and $13 billion. And we're economically vulnerable due to our reliance on exports in agricultural products. The other major indirect impact is the social disruption and hardship that these outbreaks cause. A recent analysis shows that emerging infectious diseases are increasing in frequency, and there's no reason to think that this trend will not continue. This slide shows a decade-by-decade increase in new disease events. The authors suggested that peak in the decade 1980 to 1990 is associated with new diseases that emerged during the HIV pandemic. The black line is a trend line showing a significant increase in outbreaks over time, and there's also a significant relationship between increasing vector-borne diseases, that is, diseases carried by mosquitoes and midges, and time. It's likely that these outbreaks are caused by a complex matrix of physical, social, economic, and geographic issues that are rapidly changing. And I now want to discuss these factors. Climate change is clearly with us. Increased temperature may change the geographic range of insects that carry diseases. Higher temperatures can increase the virus load and enable these vectors to survive over winter. As mentioned, increased temperature appears to have contributed to the spread of blue tongue into Northern Europe and is perhaps the best documented example of the effect of climate change on disease spread. Changing rainfall patterns allow the movement of diseases into different locations. These changing patterns, together with increase in population density, mean the way in which we use water is changing. For example, the large increase in domestic rainwater tanks can change the distribution of mosquitoes that carry dengue, as has been mentioned. Climate change will probably be accompanied by extreme weather events. Changing drought and flooding patterns will alter the incidence and patterns of disease spread in both positive and negative ways. It should be recognised that the complex combination of climate-related factors will increase the risk in some areas and decrease the risk in others. The second major factor in disease spread is the increased mobility of people and products. Both influenza and dengue have entered Australia carried by travellers. In today's global market, agricultural produce, including live animals, is easily transported around the globe and can carry diseases both into and out of Australia. For example, equine influenza entered Australia via the entry of an infected horse from Japan. Foot and mouth disease most likely entered the United Kingdom in 2001 through the importation of agricultural produce from a region where foot and mouth disease is endemic. Both prosperity and poverty affect disease emergence. Increased prosperity has resulted in changes in the way food is consumed and in livestock production systems in developing countries. The increased intensive production of livestock in situations where there is inadequate infrastructure can result in disease emergence. Intensive farming practices can also lead to disease emergence in developed countries. In the United Kingdom, the practice of feeding animal-derived protein to livestock led to the emergence of mad cow disease. Poverty also affects disease emergence and spread. Poverty leads to poor living conditions and poor infrastructure, including healthcare, and such poverty is conducive to the emergence and spread of disease. Land use is also an important issue. Changing patterns of land use have flowed from changing levels of prosperity and global access to markets. Deforestation for agricultural purposes can affect disease emergence by pushing wildlife and people closer together. Changing irrigation practice alters the distribution of insects that carry disease. As an example, habitat reduction brought fruit bats, orchards, and pigs into closer proximity and resulted in the emergence of Nipah virus in pigs in Malaysia in 1998 and 99. This disease caused significant economic loss and also infected humans, killing 105 people. And this slide shows the culling of pigs during the response operation. Nipah outbreaks continue to occur in Bangladesh, with the disease now able to spread from human to human, with a case fatality rate of 73%. The movement and numbers of people are also changing. Overcrowding in urban and peri-urban slums can result in the rapid spread of disease. In the recent outbreak of swine flu in Mexico, it's been estimated that between 6,000 and 30,000 people were infected before the outbreak was recognised by the international public health community to be caused by a new strain of influenza. In Australia, the number of people seeking an alternative lifestyle in the semi-rural regions of our cities is increasing. Many who have little or no understanding of agriculture keep small numbers of livestock on the urban fringe. This represents a biosecurity risk. For example, many people who keep small numbers of pigs in the Greater Sydney area do not understand the risks of foot and mouth disease associated with feeding food scraps such as salami to their animals. Vaccination remains a cornerstone of disease control in both humans and animals. It's a key part of any strategy to control and, if possible, eradicate epidemic disease, particularly for influenza. While quarantine, antiviral therapeutics and other public health measures will delay the spread of influenza, vaccination is the most effective and efficient way of controlling outbreaks. Where public health infrastructure is poor, it is very difficult to establish and sustain public health programs. Political or religious interference can make this more complex, as has been seen with the re-emergence of polio following the difficulties associated with vaccination programs in Nigeria. Even in developed countries, disease re-emergence is seen when vaccination rates drop. In addition to the risk factors arising in this changing world, the disease-causing agents themselves are also changing. For example, bacteria develop resistance to antibiotics, and viruses develop resistance to antiviral drugs. The relatively high multiplication rates of bacteria and viruses mean they can rapidly respond to changes in the environment. Their natural selection will favour microorganisms that do best in those new environments. The emergence of extreme drug-resistant TB is a good example. Some consider extreme drug-resistant TB to be the most significant global disease threat that we face. This disease is present in our northern neighbours. From this brief summary, it can be seen that there are a complex matrix of factors that contribute to disease emergence. The factors affect disease in humans, domestic animals, and wildlife. And there are considerable uncertainties associated with many of these related and overlapping factors. This reinforces the need to expect the unexpected. Disease outbreaks and epidemics will continue to occur. So we need the national capacity, capability, and agility to respond to these outbreaks in a cross-sectoral and cross-jurisdictional manner, in which operations are underpinned by quality research. Despite being an island nation, it would be a mistake to think we are insulated from these events. We only need to look at influenza. There are three main sources of risk: entry through our northern borders, entry through our ports and airports, and emergence of disease within Australia. Our northern borders are close to our neighbours, and it's easy to forget how close this really is. Darwin is equally close to Jakarta as it is to Perth. We know that animals and insects that carry disease can cross to Australia on a regular basis. As has been mentioned, midges carrying blue tongue viruses enter northern Australia annually with the monsoon. Bats that carry Nipah and Hendra viruses regularly cross to Australia from East Timor and Papua New Guinea. The second area of risk is entry of disease through our ports and airports. For example, swine flu has been carried to Australia by passengers on planes and boats. Dengue virus comes into North Queensland via infected travellers who are bitten by dengue-specific local mosquitoes that are then able to transmit the virus to local residents. As has already been mentioned, in 2008-2009, we had a dengue outbreak in North Queensland of over 1,000 cases that's proved very difficult to control. There is now a substantial increased risk of dengue hemorrhagic fever following inevitable future outbreaks in North Queensland. The third area of risk are the homegrown diseases, so to speak. For example, the Tasmanian devil facial tumour, which we saw on Quantum, I think, last week, was a disease that was completely unexpected. Bangawana and Menangle viruses emerged and caused diseases in our pig herds. Hendra virus is carried by bats and causes disease in humans and horses. The recent outbreak in Brisbane caused the death of a young veterinarian. We often do not investigate, or perhaps are not always well equipped to address some of these unexpected or unusual diseases effectively. In summary, we do not know where the next disease outbreak will come from, when it will occur, or what will cause it. But what we have illustrated is that the world of emerging infectious diseases with epidemic potential is one of major uncertainty and, to some extent, inevitability. We are changing the world, and this is changing the pattern of disease emergence. And therefore, as a nation, we must be well prepared to rapidly deal with these unexpected disease outbreaks and contain them before they become high-impact epidemics. I thank you for giving us the opportunity to make this presentation to you and hope you found it valuable.
Some of you may have specific questions for our scientific experts, so I'd like to ask both Anne and
Stephen, Professor Kelso, and Professor Prowse if they'd be willing to entertain questions. I also want to acknowledge the presence of Andy Carroll and Ken Baldwin, who also assisted, as did other members of the working group that couldn't be with us today, in the preparation of this report. Are there questions about the broad and important issues that you heard about today? Yes, please, Professor Kelso, Professor Prowse. Yes.
Hi, Anne, you mentioned chikungunya virus, but is it currently circulating in Australia?
I think that Stephen is better. He'll know a lot more about chikungunya than I do.
No, chikungunya is not circulating in Australia. It's currently in Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and not yet in Australia. Yeah. However, we do have the vectors.
And when you mentioned Ebola restum with a new host in the Philippines, I don't think you said what the host was.
The outbreak of Ebola restum occurred in pigs, and that's never been seen before. And a number of humans also seroconverted, so it appears that they were infected but were asymptomatic.
Just wondered whether there were any prospects for treatment for dengue fever. I think you mentioned that there is none at the moment.
There's been quite a lot of work aimed at developing vaccines for dengue. I'm not a dengue expert, but I understand they are probably still quite some way away. It's quite a challenging disease for various reasons in terms of vaccine development.
Do you have anything to add to that?
No, but I believe that's true.
You mentioned there's dengue fever and dengue hemorrhagic fever. Are both of those in northern Queensland?
As far as I know, we haven't seen dengue hemorrhagic fever in Australia.
The reason for that is that dengue hemorrhagic fever only arises after a second infection by a person who's had dengue with a different serotype. And because Australia, we've had relatively confined or constrained epidemics that haven't been huge, we don't have the number of people, just by chance, who are going to get second infections. But as we get increasing numbers of infections with increasing numbers of people, we will see increasing cases of dengue hemorrhagic fever.
My understanding is that the few fatalities we have actually been second infections. Is that correct?
I think the fatality in this latest epidemic was not a second infection. It was someone who had underlying health problems, and in some ways it's similar to what we see with influenza, where you get a serious virus infection in a person who has underlying health conditions, diabetes, kidney disease, etc., then the mortality will go up.
Are there other questions, please?
In terms of information sharing with international partners, I'd like to ask how much is Australia involved in that, not only through the WHO, but also with other countries? And in terms of finding best practices, how much emphasis is placed in that internationally in Australia, if that makes sense.
Anne, did you want to start?
You can start with influenza.
Yes, and first of all, people from the Australian government will be better placed than I am to comment on how, for example, the Department of Health through the National Incident Room at the moment is managing international interaction, but there is a great deal, as I'm aware. I know most, of course, about the WHO system, and that is a highly interactive system. For flu, there are now something like 126 designated laboratories around the world that collect influenza viruses as part of their normal diagnostic procedures and then send them on to collaborating centres like ours and the three others around the world. So that's a network of friends, if you like. We know people in many of those centres. We meet annually at meetings, and so there's a lot of sharing of information in circumstances like this. And in fact, our centre in Melbourne is receiving viruses from, particularly from Asia Pacific countries. Also managed out of Geneva is a great deal of information sharing. There've been massive teleconferences. Every mechanism you can imagine is being used. We are having informal teleconferences with CDC in the US to discuss the epidemiology of the virus. So it is interesting when you have a challenge like the pandemic we're experiencing at the moment, how all of these networks, some formal, some informal, come into play, and everybody can just get on the phone, use email, be in touch.
some of those things can't be, you can only have the platform there in advance, and then it really depends on the people contacts to make it work. Mm.
Andy, did you want to
add? Just on the animal side, we have a wide range of international reference labs and cooperating centres in Australia, including the Animal Health Lab at Geelong. So we have formal networks under the World Organisation for Animal Health, where Australia is one of the central reference points. We also have formal relations with what we call the Quads Group, which is us, New Zealand, Canada, and the USA. And we share a lot of information and viruses, etc., with those. So there are a lot of formal mechanisms as well as informal ones.
And I can just ask a follow-up question to that. When you said, for example, the picture of Australians and many people in the world having animals living together in a confined space, how much of that basic information sharing, knowledge gathered at the highest level, is actually filtered through locally, the local level to the community, and how much is the community actually aware or informed about this in Australia?
In Australia, we're actually putting quite a lot of effort in now to engage in what we call peri-urban animal populations. They can be more complex to deal with than the larger farming organisations, because they're often, one, there isn't one peri-urban group, there are a series of groups with different interests and different drivers and different levels of knowledge. So we're putting a lot of effort now in communicating with them, primarily on disease recognition and biosecurity plans. We've just finished the one for the poultry industry now, and we're trying to engage more of the peri-urban people in that piece. So that is building out, and it's internationally recognised as a problem as well. So we're not the only ones working in that area.
One takeaway number I might ask our experts to remind us of is the approximate fraction of human-induced disease that has as a source animal infection.
Mm. I showed a slide with that showed increasing new disease events, and something, it depends a little bit how it's analysed, but somewhere in the region of 60 to 70% of those new disease events are associated with an animal reservoir. And so that nexus between human disease and animal disease is particularly important, and probably being increasingly important. And we only have to look at this outbreak of influenza that we're seeing, that the animal component was where the virus originated, and by various changes, it then emerged from animals into people. We don't know exactly what the path is, but I think we can be reasonably certain that the virus has avian, swine, and human components.
43% from wild animals too.
Yes. So there's a very important wildlife disease component there. We just look at Hendra virus and fruit bats, for example, in Australia.
Please.
I was just wondering if you could update us on any new information relating to the development of a vaccine for the H1N1 virus. Has there been any sort of recent developments there that you can tell us about?
Yes, and so that's happening apace around the world, and CSL, of course, in Australia, thanks to orders from the Australian and the US governments, is proceeding with developing a vaccine. It's doing so up to this point with a North American virus, which is the most advanced in its analysis. It's one of the very early California ones, and when I say very early, it's only from April. So it's one that's been modified in several labs now to make it safe for vaccine development. So that's CSL has done its own modification of the virus. It's been shown to be substantially weakened in some animal studies, which is a precursor before it can go into actual production. I think at the moment they're making final decisions about exactly which virus to use to go into production. They are still saying that despite the complexities of making this vaccine from scratch, that they'll have doses available by August. Whether the actual rollout of that, of course, depends on how well the virus grows in eggs and all sorts of things that are currently being worked on. It's quite a complex process. There are still many variables to be sorted through, but they're really ahead of the game.
And just a supplementary question. There's been a report of a new strain of the virus
From Brazil.
Is that been confirmed yet, that it is actually a new strain?
It hasn't, and in fact, if anything, it's been confirmed that it's not a new strain. Mm. The genetic sequence information that the Brazilian lab had put into the public databases that we and others can access showed us that it was essentially identical to the North American viruses in the most important region of the molecule that changes the most rapidly. It has two spot changes, mutations of the type that I mentioned before. And those changes, as far as we can see, are not ones that you would predict will cause a particular problem. And they're in regions of the molecule, particularly one of them, where you often see changes. So we think what's happened is that the lab has said, we've isolated a virus, we've sequenced it, we've put up the information, it has a couple of changes, and then somewhere along the line the message has been turned into, this is a mutant, and because it came from a severely ill person, it's responsible for the severity of illness. I would say from what we know at the moment, it's the person, not the virus, that's responsible for these severe cases that we are seeing, a few in Australia and elsewhere. What we'll be watching out for is a significant increase in the proportion of the severe cases or the characteristics of those severe cases and a concomitant change in the virus. There are also certain things we can look for in the virus itself, but they haven't been seen yet.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
You refer to the rabies in Bali. Has that been established in Bali, or is it just cases in Bali?
No, it has been established in Bali, and as far as I'm aware, it now is likely to be endemic in Bali,
right.
Which definitely increases the risk of tourists in Bali coming back to Australia or getting rabies from monkey scratches, dog bites in Bali.
Is that the closest established population of rabies in Australia?
There is rabies on other Indonesian islands. Flores, for example, has rabies. I'm not sure. Timor? No. Don't think so.
I'm aware of, no.
No. So it's close. Flores looks a bit closer. And there are probably other islands in the Indonesian archipelago that have rabies as well.
But will that... What's the likelihood of it establishing in Australia as a result of that? Or is it just a long time off?
Someone else can take a bit of a view on that one.
I think the chance of establishing direct from there is probably fairly low, unless we get a yacht coming in and they jump a dog call from Northern Australia. It's more of a risk of slow spread and then into PNG, because as you probably know, you can stand on our Northern Torres Strait Island and see PNG. It's very close, and the likelihood of dogs going with the normal indigenous movements, there are higher. So I think the chance of it leaping from Indonesia direct to us is actually quite low, or no more than from any other rabies infected country.
Any other questions? I'd like to ask that we thank our speakers again, but I'd also like to thank you for taking time out of what must be incredibly busy days for you here in Parliament to listen to some science on a very important topic. And if you found this in any way valuable, we'd be very pleased to have that feedback either directly or through the library. Because looking forward, when we have more reports like this, if there's a way that we can continue to engage with those who work in Parliament and support those who work in Parliament, we would be very pleased to do so. So please let us know what's been of value, what's been of most value. Provide us with that feedback directly to the Office of the Chief Scientist or to the Parliamentary Library. Yes, please. So thank you, and let us also thank our speakers. Thank you for coming.
The good thing is we've got the education on this. Do it.
We're all very grateful for that.
Stephen.